I'd like to introduce the moderator for our next panel, Cross-Border Models of Life Sciences, A View Across the Value Chain. My name is Ron Eppen. I'm a partner with Edwards, Angel, Palmer, and Dodge, long-standing law firm here in Boston, product of a recent merger between Palmer and Dodge and Edwards and Angel. I'm a member of the Life Sciences Practice Group. Our moderator for this panel probably needs no introduction. Dr. Ansbert Gattaca has been referred to in the Venture Capital Journal as the biotech kingpin. Ansbert is co-founder and a general partner of the MPM Group. He began his career as a medical doctor in Germany and subsequently held research positions at the Whitehead Institute and the German Cancer Research Center. Ansbert?
Thank you. Very happy to be here, and very happy that the sort of new introduction, or as I understand it, recent introduction of life sciences into this conference is really drawing a crowd and good interest. I would like to introduce the panelists. Right next to me, Pravin Chaturvedi, who is the CEO of IndUS Pharmaceuticals. Pravin has a long 18 years of experience in drug development. Most importantly, he was the founding CEO of Sion Pharmaceuticals, but also spent many years at Vertex, Alchemies, and Park Davis. Next to him, Satish Jindal. Satish was the founder and CEO of Neogenesis, which, as many of you know, had been acquired by Schering Plough, and Satish stayed on and is now a vice president and the site head of Schering Plough in Cambridge. Next to Satish, Sandeep Lal. Sandeep is a senior director at Merck, focusing on the worldwide licensing organization, with a particular focus on China, India, as well as specific therapeutic areas like oncology and infectives, but also an interest in platform technologies. Next to Sandeep is Akhilesh Pandai, who is the founder of the Institute of Bioinformatics in Bangalore and also an assistant professor at Johns Hopkins University. And last not least, Stephen Wardell, a principal at Apeiron Partners, also heavily involved in drug development and, in fact, right now a vice president of business development in a spin-out that Apeiron is doing with a phase 3 drug. I would like to not spend any significant time with an introduction, but really use the time for questions and then particularly questions from the audience. The only point I would like to make as an introduction is when we are talking about cross-border investing, I think we are really talking about two levels. We are on one hand obviously talking about investing, U.S. investors investing in companies in India. We should probably also cover China since there are many similarities but also some striking differences. But we are also talking about investments in U.S. corporations that do a lot, or in some cases most of their operations in India or China. And I think these are two sort of slightly different things, and we may want to explore a little bit why one or the other is being preferred in certain situations. I'd like to kick off with asking a more of an overview question, which may be helpful for some of the audience, to Satish, which is in what we are talking about, biotech and pharmaceutical R&D. Maybe Satish can describe a little bit what the key components of the value chain are, and within those key components, what are the ones that are currently getting the greatest interest in respect to India.
Okay, thank you, Ansbert. So drug discovery and development, as most of you know, it's a very, very long process. It takes many years, 10 to 15 years, and most of the times there are more failures than the success stories. In fact, 9 times out of 10, one fails. So it's a very, very complicated system. There are multiple components, and it's also a very linear process. It's not a linear, non-linear process at this point. There are two main components. One is the discovery component. The other is the development component. So the discovery component includes, for example, selecting the right target, which may come from genomics or which may be come from literature. And then once you have the right target, and that's the first step, then the next step is the high-throughput screening step, where you find compounds which modulate the function of this target. And there are a number of technologies which have emerged out in last many years which have made this high-throughput screening more efficient than what it used to be. And once you have a compound which comes from high-throughput screening, it's a very early stage, and normally it's called hit stage. And then there is a very extensive medicinal chemistry efforts in fine-tuning these hits and hoping that they will meet the criteria of a drug-like compound. And these are called drug leads. And from drug leads, again, there's a pharmacokinetics, there's advanced medicinal chemistry optimization, there's a toxicology component, there's a GLP tox, and all these efforts are focused to make some of these drug leads eventually to development candidates, candidates which are ready to go into development. So normally a pharmaceutical company will spend about one-third of their total R&D budget in this early drug discovery before it goes to the clinical development. So the clinical development, again, has multiple components, phase one, phase two, phase three, and then the FDA approval. So when we are talking about this, you know, cross-border investing, so there are investments which go on along this multi-component path. Traditionally, we have seen most of the investments, you know, in India and China, they were focused on chemistry because India and China has traditionally, you know, considered a powerhouse of chemists. There are good chemists, chemistry schools there. But more recently, I think investors and also the pharmaceutical companies, they are getting interested in all different components which I just described along the drug discovery pathway, but also to do clinical development in India. I think it will be a very interesting platform to explore further what's going on along these different activities.
Yeah, thank you, Satish. It's another sort of overview question maybe for Stephen. Stephen, can you sort of give us a little bit of the big picture overview? How did sort of cross-border investing in life sciences change over the past few years, and where do you see it today?
Thanks. And I thought I would define cross-border investing broadly to include not just an investment from a U.S. investor in a new co in India or an established company in India, but also the spending on infrastructure and the moving of departments from Western Europe and the U.S. Into India. And so defined broadly, that has really, I think, been growing beyond expectations and more broadly than people would have expected as recently as 2 or 3 years ago. In fact, as recently as 2 or 3 years ago, there was an idea, or I'd call it a conceit, in the established biopharma world, in the successful clusters like the Bay Area, Boston, you know, the London, Cambridge area, the Munich area, that there were certain things that they would do. They would keep the most senior executives. They would do the work that was the most regulatorily difficult at home, and they would kind of farm out the easier and the lower value added portions to India. And today, I think that there's really no portion that people think in the next 10 years that India won't be able to do. So in the medium term, 10 years, India will be able to duplicate, very likely, everything that Western Europe and the U.S. and Japan are doing. I think there are some obstacles to India's success. One would be the creation of a successful cluster, which is very hard to do. And another is stronger regulatory system, higher regulatory standards, and higher IP protection in India, which India has moved toward recently. I think that's important, but is not as strong as the ICH standards today or the US FDA standards today. So India is strong in many segments, its low prices are driving not just increased or more cost-effective R&D spending, by the traditional pharma industry, but they're also driving innovation because it's critical that innovation not be too expensive. Costs hold innovation back, and India is likely to become is already becoming more of a growing center of innovation, with low cost driving that innovation. I mean, I think every large pharma company now has a presence in India, and 7 out of the world's 10 largest CROs now have major India offices. So this is just showing how established India has become very quickly. 10 years ago, no one would have predicted this. And lastly, I thought I would just cite an example of Quintiles, which is the leading CRO. And 2 years ago, they decided to move their entire ECG reading office to India. And then they opened up the office with the capability of operating at lower costs on a 24/7 basis with a response, the reading of an ECG in the context of a clinical trial within 1 hour. And no one had that capability before Quintiles offered that capability, and they did it in India, and they did it for lower cost than it would have taken to offer a normal capability in the U.S. or Western Europe. So that is the sort of capability that we are looking to see, and there's a room for argument whether the quality would be the same, and I think it's fair to say 2 years later that it's about equal, which is good, very good news for India. But that is the sort of competitive challenge and competence and capability that India has to offer.
Thank you, Stephen. I mean, you mentioned a specific service component that works very successful in India. And Satish had mentioned primarily a focus on chemistry. I'm wondering whether Sandeep could, from the large pharma perspective, tell us a little bit more what other areas can be particularly interesting.
It's from a big pharma or large pharma perspective. Frankly, we see it at even a broader level. So R&D is just one aspect of that. Obviously, there are opportunities in manufacturing. India is only second after United States in number of FDA-approved GMP sites. I think that number is around just northward of 70 at this point. It's a good source of sourcing API and raw materials and so forth. So it's an excellent opportunity for either raw materials or even finished products, if you will, from India. We also see opportunity from a marketing standpoint. So for a large pharma company which does not have a presence in India, there are many Indian companies who have 2,000, 3,000, 5,000 size sales force, if you will. So if you're looking at a market entry strategy, I'm just giving you an example, and there are many other companies that are also looking at the same sort of opportunities. So we essentially see it as across the value chain, if you will, from R&D, manufacturing, and marketing.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And maybe Praveen, who spent, I think, many years in smaller companies, can sort of add a little bit from the smaller company perspective what you think is particularly interesting there that should or could be done in India.
So it set the stage for being provocative, and so I shall be. I think there are obviously varying themes on the subject, but you can broadly think of it in two ways. And one is from the emerging markets standpoint, which is more along the lines what Sandeep was alluding to on the commercialization end. And there's definitely cost arbitrage as well as immediate near-term opportunity that is drawing attention. But I think on a more broader scale, on the productivity side of R&D, for those of you who were here in Clay Christensen's talk last night or had the good fortune of listening to at least one out of the three excellent keynote addresses this morning, the big theme that we have focused on from a biotech standpoint is the absolute diminution and minimal returns on investment in R&D productivity. And since markets have shifted, to take Clay Christensen's example from last night, and the rich have to focus on the high-end markets. And the disruptive innovation came from the Genentechs and Amgens and Biogens and Vertex of the world. That is now becoming that they're becoming more middle-stage developers. Drug discovery as a whole is absolutely void at this point in time. And it is not a modular function. It's an integrated, multidisciplinary effort. So knowledge transfer, which was alluded to this morning by several people, is key. And that knowledge transfer will come by stitching together the competencies from the West and the East. And so where the value creation is, where a significant contribution will be made for a long term in this globalization of innovation effort, is going to be from companies that are like the Verifones that Mr. Tayabji was describing, who are able to then leverage the strengths and provide knowledge and integrate the knowledge rather than providing prescriptions, as Dr. Douglas referred to, of what should be done, because the point is to tap into intellectual potential, not the pair of hands.
Thank you. We haven't really addressed, and I think that's probably a very much growing area, the role of bioinformatics that India can play in general, and it's probably an area that Akhilesh is very versed on addressing.
Yes, I think what is easily forgotten in this new age of systems biology and bioinformatics is that India was one of the early countries that emerged as a major player in bioinformatics. This was in the late 80s before it became a buzzword. And as Frank Douglas pointed out earlier today, what is really lacking is that we do not have the large data sets that are needed to drive this drug development, this systems biology. And what ends up happening in both academic labs and in the pharma and the big and not so big pharma is that there is a lot of data from many disparate sources. And we don't have, that is, in the United States alone, the capability to analyze such data effectively. And then this data has to be stitched together with data from other sources, like was pointed out by Satish here, from the literature. What have other people found? And then this has to be integrated with what is happening out in the population. There is a subset of patients that responding to a certain altered form of something. You know, we all talk about personalized medicine, but it's going to remain a pipe dream unless we put a serious thrust on not what is considered a boring in silico analysis, but bioinformatics as it combines molecular biology and chemistry and structural biology. And India has the potential to contribute, is just largely been ignored. And I think I would like to see in the coming years an active participation of India. And I'm sure it'll happen because this country, United States, just does not have the capability to do it. And you cannot produce people who have such interdisciplinary skills overnight, even over the course of years. We are talking about starting master's and PhD programs, but the numbers are abysmally low.
Would like to, rather than ask any specific panelists to answer, sort of open it up to the panel, and whoever wants to jump in, please jump in as we get to a few more specific questions. There's always a lot of discussion about the issue of intellectual property, and particularly in China, I think it's a very big issue, and people try to, I think, design work that they do in China around it so that it couldn't hurt them. I mean, one interesting example I saw recently is that one of the top U.S. pharmaceutical companies built a very significant chemistry facility there, 250 chemists. But what they do is they actually synthesize competitors' compounds that this particular pharmaceutical company then uses for a competitor, for basically studying the direct comparison between their compounds in development and competitor compounds. And they're certainly not much concerned, I guess, about their competitors' IP as much. But can any of you sort of comment a little bit where this stands in India? Is it a concern for investors or Western companies?
I can probably say a little bit about from a large company perspective, I still think that this is the biggest challenge. I think there is no doubt in anyone's mind that India is going to be a leader in next many years, 10, 15 years, in this biotechnology and drug discovery. But still, large companies, they are not putting, in my opinion, yet, emphasis on the strategic projects outsourcing to India and China. They, you know, they're still, at least they were still doing, you know, some of the chemistry projects, you know, making building blocks or, as Sandeep mentioned, making APIs in manufacturing. And there is a concern, although the patent laws have changed, but the concern is enforcement of patent laws. And, you know, it's interesting, someone in Big Pharma made a comment that, yes, there are patent laws in India, but it's like traffic laws. It's very difficult to enforce them. Okay, so I think still that concern is still there. And I don't know how, I think unless some of these companies in India, they address these issues directly, this will remain a very big concern, because, you know, you are talking about a hundreds of millions of dollars of investment, and the reputation of India is, you know, that they have succeeded very well in generics. They know how to copycat the drugs. I think that mentality still is lingering on in the pharmaceutical industry. Yeah, and it's a big challenge.
Can I speak? Yeah, please.
So a counterpoint.
Yeah.
So I think when we, about 15 months ago, embarked on the broad vision for starting Indus, this was in the light of India becoming a part of the WTO TRIPS agreement. And actually, almost by good fortune, we had a chance to interface with a couple of the ministry folks, some of whom negotiated the WTO TRIPS agreement. Now, India, as most of you know who are Indian in origin, has 145 political parties in a democratic system, from extreme left to extreme right. And so they had to manage a lot of expectations and constituent objections. Nonetheless, they were able to go through that, and the ministry person, to the very point that Satish just made, when one of my colleagues made that comment, he took umbrage with that, strong objections, and he said, India, like the United States, has independent legislative, executive, and judiciary systems. Now, we just became a part of the WTO TRIPS agreement. If you file an IP today, it's up for adjudication about 3 years from now, 4 years from now. And we respect the courts of Netherlands and England, neutral courts. And therefore, you can seek injunctive relief not only within courts in India as well as overseas in neutral countries which have common English law. So that was the first comment to that. And to prove point, when we did a deal with the Indian government, in fact, that's the arbitration and jurisdiction are in the courts of England, is what the Indian government agreed to. Yesterday, before in planning for this panel session, I had seen the questions that Peter had mailed. I called the Ministry of Science and Technology and asked the secretary of the department, how do you want me to answer in case ANSPERT asked me to answer this question? And for the non-Indians, I will say something in Hindi, what he said, and then I'll translate for you. He said, "Salo ki khal udher denge, jo violate karenge unka." Okay? That's what he said, which means we're going to skin the bastards who violate the WTO TRIPS law. This is an objective assessment made by the Indian government. We are going to continue to do this, and we're going to enforce it. So while Satish is absolutely right, I don't drive in India because I'm petrified. More of the people coming in front of my car than anything else. I do agree that this is a long-term process and will take time and some maturity, but that should not prevent companies like mine, who are actually building and creating IP from India, and we have US-issued patents to show for that.
I think that's when you talk about, so there's a pharma company which is traditionally very conservative. They are not known to be risk takers. But I think for India, not only IP, but even for outsourcing, I think there are more opportunities for small biotech companies in US who can use the India infrastructure. And the main reason for that is I think the timings have changed. You know, there was a time when you have interesting technology, you will get investment from investors. But if you go to Ansbert now, he wants to see the compounds. Okay, and he will not even talk to you unless you have pretty late-stage compounds. And where these late-stage compounds are going to come from? Okay, the one way is that you license them back from Big Pharma, and yes, you can do that, but they are not going to give you great compounds. The other is to start something where you have interesting idea, you can take a risk, maybe a new target. Because pharma companies, again, they are the only way they think the target is good because somebody else is working on that. And biotech companies, they can be more, they can take more risks, and they can use India infrastructure to advance these targets to a stage when it becomes interesting for people like Ansbert, and you can do it cheaply. I think that's where I think India can provide a very strong infrastructure.
Yeah. So I think from a Merck standpoint, we left India back in mid-70s because of patents. And now we are back in India because of patents. So we have a very clear position on IP. I mean, from our perspective, it's very binary. So either you enforce patents or you don't, right? So there is no middle ground. So the fact that India has ratified TRIPS, we are now going in openly and are exploring many, many options, if you will, in terms of increasing our infrastructure in India. We're already doing some early stage medicinal chemistry work. We have been doing that for even before the TRIPS ratification, but we are looking to scale that up through a variety of partnerships and so forth. So at the end of the day, I mean, there's a risk of IP leakage anywhere, right? Anywhere in the world, there's a risk. And what has to go in the process is the due diligence that you go through in terms of selecting a partner or selecting the type of project that you might want to take on at this stage of the game. I mean, my personal feeling is that I think the basic infrastructure is there, the laws are in place, there's a good awareness. The companies that we have dealt with in India, IP is definitely at the top of their minds, if you will, in terms of as an element to discuss when you're talking about terms or the contract. So they are by no means novices in that area. They're very sophisticated. And obviously, as part of those contracts, they have a great deal of interest in retaining the IP under the assumption the IPs will be enforced in India. In fact, I'm seeing the same thing in China. So while we may sit here and speculate that there is an IP risk, the actual sophistication of many Chinese companies and potential partners is actually quite high. IP is valued at a fair amount of premium, if you will, and they fight tooth and nail when you come to contract discussion in terms of owning that IP. I guess bottom line for me is, personally, is that in a flat world, the only unflattener is IP, and that applies as well to U.S. companies as well as to Indian companies. So in a flat world where things, goods, and money can move across the borders very quickly, the only thing that can control or that gives you a barrier to entry and makes the plain uneven is IP or not having IP.
I'd just like to add that I think that IP is very important and it's part of a much bigger issue. And the bigger issue is, what does success look like for India in the life sciences 20 years from now? I think success is many local and foreign pharma companies, many local and foreign biotech companies, many local and foreign investors, many local and foreign service companies competing, starting hundreds and thousands of ventures, making attempts, failing, dropping programs, adding new ones, following trends, and competing vigorously and producing many valuable products, life-saving therapeutics, medical devices, and diagnostics in a flurry, just like San Francisco is today, just like Boston is today. And to get there, what do you need? What do you need for success down the road? Well, you need a number of big things, of which India has many today, has some of them today, and they're improving in India, and that's a good sign, but India needs to go farther. So one is, you need the highest regulatory standards. You need to make the decision that Japan made in the 60s and 70s to have the highest regulatory standards, even though that imposed higher costs and delays and other unhappy things on Japan's industry. Today, you have a thriving world-class industry today, which wasn't necessarily going to be the case if they hadn't imposed the highest standards in the 60s and 70s, and they had to actively do that and work hard to do that. The next is IP, stronger IP protection in India. Today, data exclusivity rights are weak in India, and that was a compromise in India's parliamentary system, and they could be stronger tomorrow, and I think they should be stronger. In addition, competition between foreign and domestic and within the markets should be level. there shouldn't be a favoritism. And today there is some favoritism in India, cultural and legal, and that is diminishing, and that's a good sign. And lastly, business law should support and promote innovation and growth. And India's, compared to other nations, is pretty good on that standard, but certainly could be improved. So I think for India to be a success 20 years from now, it needs to progress on all of these levels, and IP is one of the most important. And India has come a long way. In the 70s, India established IP protection for process only, and that allowed local generics in India to invent around the patents of multinational pharma in order to create the thriving Indian generic drug industry that we have today. And last year, India upgraded its IP protection in a very divisive, difficult debate within India's system, you know, democratic system. They agreed to do this, but they have farther to go, but these are good signs. And I think that what could prevent success 20 years from now would be India's falling down or going backward on some of these points.
We want to, in a moment, open the discussion up to questions to the audience, but as a last area that I would like to explore, I would like to spend a moment in comparing India and China, because China is clearly, in some ways, emerging as a key competitor to India. And I'm also asking this question because it's puzzling me a little bit. I'm not exactly sure what the answers are. On one hand, I feel that sort of India clearly has some major advantages in attracting U.S. investors, in that the legal system is sort of more familiar with us. Certainly, there's no language barrier. There's a much longer history in the pharmaceutical industry in India. And there's, if you compare the number of FDA-approved manufacturing sites, for instance, between India and China, there's a dramatic difference. So all of these things should favor investing in India. On the other hand, if you look at what happened during the last couple of years, you see a major move of U.S. investors, both VC firms as well as private equity firms, establishing offices in China and seeing sort of very significant deal flow there, and also making a lot of investments in China, which I think at this point is probably, I would guess, an order of magnitude higher in life sciences than what it is in India. And it puzzles me a little bit, because it's not completely clear to me why that is so. In respect to our own firm, I would say the main reason why we are currently about to make a couple of investments in China, and we are not as close to doing that in India. It's simply deal flow. We see dozens and dozens of companies coming with business plans from China. In most cases, they are run by Chinese management that had spent many years in the U.S. and is now back in China. And we just don't see that kind of deal flow out of India. And I talked, in preparation to this panel, I talked with a few colleagues to make sure that we are not sort of an outlier here, and that there are hundreds of Indian business plans and none gets to us and they all go to our competitors. But it looks like our competitors have a similar experience. And I'm wondering, from the panel's perspective, why is that so?
You want to go first?
Yeah, we need volunteers for this one.
Okay, yeah.
I'll go second.
You can go first. Yeah.
Oh, you want to go first. All right, I'll go first. I think it's a question of the hour, and it's something that is very dear to Indus at this point in time. It's hard to get objective information from public competitive sources about what's really transpiring in China. India, on the other hand, has a very, very wonderfully British-like sensational media, and every time you go outside the room, you'll be photographed by the paparazzi and talked about. So you can learn a lot more from just public sources and getting to Times of India on the web and learning about what's going on. India has a traditional history of family-owned businesses, and governance structure that basically comprises you, your wife, your brother, your father-in-law, and your mother-in-law. And that pretty much is your governance structure. And so it has been a big shift for them to consider taking institutional money at a large scale. On the other hand, since it is a free market economy and a democratic society, it is not government that is infusing all the capital, and private sector is expected to make a majority, more than 90% of the funds committed to the company. This basically allows the industry to operate, particularly multidisciplinary, capital-intensive and time-intensive industry like pharmaceutical industry, to be pretty much run by family-owned money that has a lot of family money. And only recently, and I'll speak personally for myself, I would not have gone to India without a WTO TRIPS agreement in place, because the manufacturing cost lowering, outsourcing alone was not attractive enough for me, because for me, I wanted to tap into the intellectual capital. So in evaluating what was available in China from a knowledge standpoint vis-a-vis India, at least in my analysis personally, China is way ahead in biology and in vaccines and protein manufacturing. And they have made a significant commitment since they became a part of WTO TRIPS in 2001, 4 years ahead of India, to new product development, biological new product development, and they have set up what is called a state FDA, SFDA, which is very comparable to that in the US, albeit kind of has some chinks in the armor. And they have aggressively advanced new product development. So in a recent analysis from the public sources on what is new product development in India vis-a-vis that in China, India had only 19 new products that could be defined as new products by our standards, that have, five of them have entered phase 2A. China had 139 new products, of which over 60 were in the clinical stage. Most of them, in fact, 99% of them, biologics. In fact, Indus itself has been approached by Chinese small chemical companies to have a partnership with China, because they view India as a better strategic partner for chemistry and not biology. So I think when one talks about Ansbert, what you're seeing a repatriation of over 700,000 Chinese MD PhDs who trained in the United States back to China as of government sources end of 2004. India does not have that kind of a repatriation model and is relying mostly on knowledge transfer and mobility of knowledge from the Thai community. So it is a bit of a time and a temporal issue for us, because we have a late start to that. On the other hand, I think Indian entrepreneurs here who have successfully bridged companies on IT side and the wireless side between Boston and Bangalore or San Francisco and Bangalore, we are equally motivated on the life sciences side to do the same.
Okay, thank you. I would like to open it up to questions from the audience, and probably be most useful if you use the microphones that you see around here.
Questions, anybody?
Okay. At least one. Wanted to ask if you were to go forward to 2026, assuming India does what it's supposed to do and China does what it's supposed to do, how do you view a vision of future of drug development in this flat world? How do you actually see companies or an entrepreneur sitting in Boston deciding how to play out the entire advantage of the globe, which is open to him by that point, in life sciences the way it is in tech today, and actually be able to leverage the cost advantages, the intellectual capital? How would an ideal company look like 20 years from now?
Well, if I understand your question, you're asking that how one can take advantage of the cost in India, is that?
Well, if I'm an entrepreneur sitting here trying to make decisions on how will I deploy or leverage all these global capabilities I have available to me, in this, for example, 20 years from now, it decides there's no WTO issue, there's no intellectual property loss issue. How would I go about in 20 years? You know, let's go 20 years from now, so that by that time it'd be a mature market. Right. How will an entrepreneur look to getting a product to market using China, India, US, Europe, wherever?
Okay.
Go ahead. Yeah, so I think let's if you make the assumption that the world is flat, and that is applicable to the pharma industry as well as the biotech, I think one opportunity or one possible scenario is that the early stage financing that is available in US is getting, that pool of capital is just getting smaller and smaller, right? So folks like Ansberg desire later stage or well-profiled compounds before they can put a lot of capital at risk. So one option would be for an entrepreneur to take an early stage opportunities such as a target and a hit, which I would not say they are commodities, but they are, I would say there are plenty of them out there available at a relatively low cost, if you will, or even if you're an entrepreneur and you have some access to your labs, if you will, to those type of assets. Those can be rather easily deployed, if you will, either in India or China for further profiling, if you will, to get your safety data or to even work on the lead compound to further optimize that. And as you gather more value, as you develop that program further, you build a value. In a flat world, the molecule will have the same valuation whether you are sitting in India or in US. If it's a good molecule, it's a good molecule. And you're most likely going to get sort of the industry norms, if you will, from a valuation standpoint. So it's a way, it's an arbitrage, it's a cost arbitrage, but at the end of the day, I think it's also capability arbitrage, because suddenly it opens up a door. So for instance, from a big pharma perspective, a negative NPV project suddenly becomes a positive NPV project. So it's a very significant enabler, right? So same way for a venture capitalist or even an entrepreneur, things which were perhaps not feasible suddenly become feasible. And you can go all the way up to proof of clinical concept in either India or China, right? That's where the valuation really skyrockets. So if you can show that a compound is safe, it engages the target, and you can establish some basic proof of concept in humans, and all of this is doable in India at this point or China, you would get a very fairly strong valuation at that point for a target which is of interest to let's say, a Western company or even to VCs. So I see that as a sweet spot. The other option could be, another model could be, you take assets here in a fire sale, let's say if it's a compound which is really has some toxicity issues or some other issues, you take that, you modify that in either India or China using MedChem resources, and then take that on and build value from an asset which otherwise was languishing or did not have an overall good value, if you will. So that's just one model.
I have a short comment on that, and I think this pertains to what I see is going to happen in 20 years. And I think science is going to be global, and I think all of these changes will be driven by that fact. The world, there will be basically no inequality. Today, we are talking from the perspective that US is stronger, and how can it benefit from India and China. I think this will not be our vocabulary 20 years from now. 20 years from now, we are going to be in a position the way Coca-Cola is manufactured today. You have local bottling plants, you have the people doing the same thing, everything is local. And what I think might happen is there will be local giants, they will be working together with the giants who will be located here, and everyone will choose projects or things of their interest. And that may be local, but everyone will be able to go from A to Z in their existing scenario. And I think 20 years is really a long time.
So I will say that those are two opportunities, but I think there is a, from an entrepreneurial model and a long-term model, there's a third model that's emerging. And that is where truly there's an intellectual property integration and independent creation of R&D franchises. So there is no mothership and there is no reintegration of the product development into something. It's a new product development enterprise. and to make my case from personal experience. So we have taken intellectual property from Indian Institutes of Excellence that have IP, and two top 10 medical universities of the United States here have asked me personally to be on their SAB because they have biology and early drug discovery IP that is pretty non-commercializable in this environment. And they are willing to almost put that for free into Indus to actually allow reintegration of intellectual property assets from the United States with those of India and to engineer new compounds. So no longer will it be a target selected by the ultimate scientist sitting in New Jersey, Boston, or San Francisco, but it is more a collegial and a truly integrated effort. And I'm actually about to take action on that as well, because I think that is the future model, like the film industry, actually.
One more question.
Okay. This is, unfortunately, due to the scarcity of time, this is going to be the last one. People who want to talk to the panel members can go to the speaker breakout room, which is 302, and you can continue your questioning there. We have back-to-back sessions, so we can't really go ahead with the Q&A anymore. So you can go ahead with the question, sir.
Just a quick question here. Maybe it might be a long answer, though, depending on how you're interested. We are talking here, sitting in the United States, primarily imagining drugs for global markets. However, often you need drugs for local markets. How would this cross-global development, especially for big pharma, mean developing drugs, let's say, for Africa or Asia that are more particular? Hopefully, we will continue the diversity rather than the SARS-like global spread that we'll have to deal around the world. So could you comment on, both from an entrepreneurial point of view, on this regional versus global pharma efforts versus developing molecules for local?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. You know, it is true that, when large pharma thinks, or even biotech in U.S., they think about the global markets. And this is the reason that many companies are not pursuing drugs for malaria, for example, or antibacterial or antifungal. And I think that's a big opportunity for entrepreneurial world to develop these kind of molecules by resourcing, outsourcing, or setting up a company in India, because there's a patient population there, and there is a knowledge there. There are resources to do that. And once you have a compound, which works, I think you can then, if you come to U.S. company, they will be very open-minded to make deals with these companies if you wish, or you can pursue these compounds on your own in clinical development and further commercialization. I think that's a big I think unmet medical need which can be filled in India.
Just one little addition to that. I think the one thing one has to think about what the regulatory hurdles are and the costs that are implied by those and how that will work with the sort of ultimate market size. And malaria, I think, is an excellent example, because if you are a commercial organization and you want to meet the regulatory hurdles to develop a new drug or vaccine, let's say for malaria, and you then take into account that the countries where you have the market want to have low-cost drugs or need low-cost drugs, there's just no way today to sort of make that work. So given that, I think over the next years, it's unlikely that countries would pay huge amounts for these more localized drugs. I think one would have to, in a way, lower the regulatory hurdles to lower the cost of drug development. That would be one way to make it work. Or it has to come from not-for-profit or government funding. But I think for companies who need to make profit, it's a difficult one.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, thank you.